Hi, I'm Deborah Holchip, editor of Michigan Today. Welcome to the 25th episode of Listen in Michigan, a celebration of the miracle that I have actually survived making 24 of these podcasts. No small feat for a print journalist working alone in a recording studio. I have cut together some of my favorite snippets from the podcast so far. If you haven't listened or subscribed yet, I hope you will. As you'll hear, I have a lot of fun with my subjects. I'm going to start with episode 15, featuring Jerry Billick, a composer, arranger, and musician who began arranging with the Michigan Marching Band in the 50s under William Ravelli. Jerry created arrangements for the band when he was just a sophomore that fans still hear today. He is the best. Here he is talking about a time that the marching band tipped its hat to the hi-fi. That's an old record player with speakers for you kids in the back. Here's Jerry.
I was, in music school, and I had become very interested in music theory and acoustics. And I began analyzing my own scores of what Ravelli was looking for. And I will tell you what happened. I mentioned a hi-fi show. Mm-hmm. I did an arrangement of Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor. I don't know if you know. It's an organ piece.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And it was going to be about a stereo system. So we said, the announcer said, of course, you have to have the tweeters, the high notes. And then the band went, da da da. And you have to have the mid-range. And you have to have the woofers. You had all this stuff. And I mean, it was designed that way. We knew that that's what they were going to say. And then in that piece, there's a kind of a pyramid where all the instruments come in on top of each other. We were playing it in the stadium. This is probably the second year I was arranging. And all of a sudden, the entire stadium stood up. And started screaming. And Ravelli was conducting, and he turned around. He thought some woman was getting passed up or whatever it was. They were all, pointing at the band and screaming. And what had happened, thank Bach for this, but the way the chords lined up, they reinforced each other, and the sound, it totally consumed the stadium. Every air molecule in that stadium was vibrating. And when that happened, and we all, I was playing at that time. It was the first time I saw the music move the stadium.
And you're still And you're still a student at this time. You're just a young kid, right?
A sophomore. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I love that episode. Okay, here's another favorite episode, Lucky Number 13. It's about a book called Iconic Restaurants of Ann Arbor, co-written by an alum named Gail Offen. Gail will take you back in time to the diners, dives, and pubs that made your college and Ann Arbor experience so memorable. You can practically taste that orange sauce at Pizza Bob's when she talks about it. Here's Gail describing how food, memory, and nostalgia work together to stimulate your mental palate.
Sometimes it's the food. Sometimes it's a place, like, for example, the Pretzel Bell. So many people celebrated their 21st birthday there. So it was like a rite of passage mm-hmm. kind of place. And so people would go there, and they would tell their friends to go there. And again, it was really iconic. But then I look at a place like Dominic's, and their schedule revolves around U of M. They open up in spring break, and they close the week after the last home game. So you think about it. It's mostly spring and summer. You're sitting outside. You're with your friends. And so that's the kind of thing you look back again in your mind's eye. You can see yourself sitting there, almost like a movie, mm-hmm. sitting there and enjoying things with your friends. So I think a lot of these gathering places are the places that people, or people remember, for example, Drake's. My mother used to study at Drake's, and that was a long time mm-hmm. ago. And so, again, you remember some of those little cozy moments where you would be in a booth at Drake's eating a grilled pecan roll and drinking a limeade. And that, there's no other place you could do that.
And then you bring up an interesting point, being able to go someplace that your parents may have gone, or your children can come to a place where you may have gone, that connection.
That loop, it's so true, because I find people tell me when they come in for football games, they always go, I always go to Pizza Bob's, or I always go to this place. My uncle used to make donuts at the Brown Jug, and the Brown Jug actually is the longest surviving restaurant now still operating. It's been around since 1936. So I think about that. I think about my uncle working there. I think about my mother at Drake's. I think about all these places that I also went to. And then you look back at some of these places, you look where Drake's is now, and it's a Brugger's bagel, mm-hmm. and you go, really? Nobody could save Drake's? You look back, and it's just, you look at some of these icons and think, why couldn't somebody have stepped in and saved them?
How much do you love Gail and her Michigan accent? And I say that with true affection, I promise. All right, next we have a nutty interview with sports writer and alumnus John U. Bacon. He released a book of some of his favorite essays last year, The Best of Bacon. It was the perfect opportunity to talk through some of his nuttiest experiences, literally trying out for sports teams a la George Plimpton and Paper Lion to give his readers the most visceral sports experience. John really cracks me up, as this clip from episode 20 reveals. I love your self-deprecating humor on these, like, George Plimpton adventures you went on. Like, there's a hockey one. And football, too, right?
Yep.
There's one where there's a lot of puking.
Yeah, that's the football one. And hockey was pretty close.
The one where you were, like, your whole body, like, shut down.
Oh, it did. I tried out for the Detroit Vipers hockey team and lost 6 pounds the hard way, and that was brutal. The hardest one by far, though, was working out with Mike Barwis, the old strength coach at Michigan, back in 09. And I puked every day for a week and a half working out with those guys. I couldn't walk after these workouts. You couldn't get down the steps. I mean, you really did. We went home, and you got on your couch in the fetal position, and you whimpered for an hour, and you realized, I'm going to die here. You have to get up and feed yourself in some way. And that's when I realized, and by the way, no exaggeration, anybody's gone through this, it's called hypertrophy. It's where your body, as you said, just breaks down. It's a cataclysmic event to your body. It just shuts down. And these guys go through it twice a year. And then they get used to it, and they start lifting weights again. Read that piece, and you will see Michigan football players in a different light. Man, it is not an easy life. And I don't care if they are full rides. Those are not free rides.
Yeah.
They pay a price.
Well, if anyone knows about respecting athletes, it is John. Okay, on to our next clip. This is award-winning, beloved, and revered Professor Ralph Williams. You kind of have to say his name like that because he speaks like this in a very important way. He is an expert in religion and Shakespeare, and he's one of those people who places extremely high importance on civility, mutual respect, dignity, and so on. Here's Ralph in an especially thoughtful moment about the meaning of life. This is episode 6.
Happiness is not a state into which you fall. It's a choice of the will. And it's always against odds. I'm not Pollyanna, and I am in anguish and moral anger at the pains and injustices of the world. I've studied and studied and studied, but the grand answers out there are frequently not available, and so you need to make a choice, right? And I don't know, frankly, whether as a race we're going to make it, whether as a society we're going to make it, right? I don't know, finally, whether love is at the basis of the universe, what Dante speaks of as the love which moves the sun and other stars, right? But one makes a commitment, finally, if one chooses, that that's the way it should be, and tries to work that out, right? And that's an arduous thing.
Ralph is so amazing. True Michigan treasure. All right, now here's an interesting one from episode 21. You're about to hear from photographer-filmmakers Andy Sachs and Jay Cassidy, two alumni who worked as staff photographers at the Michigan Daily in 1968, when Robert F. Kennedy came to Detroit prior to announcing his candidacy for president. It was the first time these young photojournalists had ridden in an open-air motorcade, taking photos, standing up in a moving convertible alongside representatives from Life and Time and all sorts of magazines. Their images are among the last photos taken of RFK. He was assassinated 3 weeks later. The first voice you will hear is Andy's.
I talked with a friend of mine the other night, and she said, well, you know, when you're 20 years old, you don't think you're inexperienced.
You know, it helped us as teenagers grow a lot, the Michigan Daily. I mean,
yeah.
Because we were thrust into, you know, a situation where you're dealing with adults, and you have to deal with them, because that's the mandate of the paper.
If I look back at the pictures of me that Jay shot, for instance, I look pretty green and kind of unkempt, but I was concentrating on what was going on. We kind of knew the ropes, and we were going to go about our job and get some good pictures from the day. Do you have any sense of that, Jay?
Yeah, look, the ethos of the Michigan Daily was we're a national newspaper, and we're going to cover stories like a national paper. You know, so when there was activity on a national level in the geographic area, the Daily covered it.
So, or beyond the geographic area.
And beyond, yeah.
Yeah, Larry Robbins and I went to Cape Canaveral because we didn't think they should shoot a rocket to the moon without us witnessing it, you know.
Yeah, so that part of that certainly is the arrogance of youth at the same time, it's why the paper was respected, is because it did assume a kind of an attitude that, that said, well, you know, there's the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Michigan Daily.
Well, maybe not in that order.
As a former college journalist myself, I love those two. All right. Finally, we're going to take you out on this clip from episode 23 in late 2018 with alumnus and filmmaker Dan Chase, who recently completed a documentary called Football's Valhalla about legendary and super enthusiastic football announcer Bob Ufer. Those of you who are fans will remember Ufer's unique euphorisms and wacky turns of phrase that add so much color and laugh-out-loud humor to every football broadcast. Dan's got some great stories from the interviews he conducted for the picture. He even teared up once while we chatted. Here's Dan.
I think I was probably about 7 or 8 years old, and my mother was listening to Bob Ufer on a little portable radio that she would carry around the house. And she'd be doing housework, and she'd have this radio on, and I was thinking, well, why on earth is my mother listening to a football game? This is, you know, sports. I didn't think of her as being a sports fan in particular. She was entertained by all of his euphorisms and all of his funny phrases and his, you know, I'm sure just his sheer joy. And the one that I was probably my favorite is running down that mod sod like a penguin with a hot herring in his cummerbund.
That's genius.
You know, and I have Anne Curzan breaking that down.
So cute.
She's great. She says something like, well, let's start with mod sod. You know, and proceeds to, you know, kind of work through it. You know, where do you get the penguin? Where do you get the hot herring? You know, that's a fun,
that's so
you know,
cute.
That's one of my favorites that's fun. But there, you know, there's so many others. He could run in the phone booth for 15 minutes and never touch the sides. Also, a big thing with Bob Ufer was nicknames. He nicknamed a lot of the players, which also made them kind of more legendary. Rick Leach, the guts and glue of the maize and blue. You know, Anthony the Darter Carter. All these things added to his flavor and helped to, you know, magnify these heroes that we were following.
2 minutes and 25 seconds remaining. It's a cliffhanger here from Ann Arbor. A barn burner, call it what you will. Wide to the right is Bo Rather. It's Taylor deep and Seifert close. Larry Sippa under center in a balanced line. Sippa rolls out to the right. Pitches off to Taylor, and Taylor's to the 20. Down to the 15, down to the 10, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Touchdown, Billy Taylor! Touchdown, Billy Taylor! Billy Taylor scored a touchdown from 21 yards out. The crowd goes berserk.
Well, thanks so much for listening. I hope this inspires you to check out my past episodes. You have 24 to choose from. Find Listen in Michigan at iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitchers, and TuneIn. Also, we are always under the Topics tab at michigantoday.umich.edu. Okay, take it easy. See you next time. Until then, you know what to do. Go Blue.